This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 16th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's programme, we look at an attempt, now halted, to rebuild the Buddhas of Banyan.
Also ahead, we'll speak to the author who bills himself as the productivity ninja, whose new book promises to help you worry less and achieve more in an increasingly chaotic world.
And before our hour together is out, we'll bring you Monocle's guide to the key news stories to keep an eye on over the week ahead. And we'll also bring you some music too.
And among the other music on offer today are some of the icy strains of Sweden's Ice Orchestra, whose instruments are made entirely of the cold stuff.
Every living thing cried out, "Come be my lover."
We are using the pun cool for that. We'll speak to the man in charge of that project.
And all that, plus more, in this edition of the Monocle Weekly. Sorry, I was a bit carried away there.
Really? You were riffing along with the Ice Orchestra?
No, I was imagining what kind of bit of the stalactite, or it's an icicle rather, he was playing. Stalactite? I'm in the wrong part of the world. I was the wrong dangly thing. Don't drop your pen, Rob.
I dropped my pen with the excitement.
It's all going off in here, isn't it?
It is all going off in here.
I mean, I'm intrigued to know how that happened to be a kind of a piece of ice.
That
man playing that thing was playing something made out of ice.
I feel that all will be revealed. Don't fret.
Okay. I'll hold on. I'll hold on.
Yeah, exactly. It sounds like a good show, doesn't it? Are you familiar with the One Show on BBC One for our UK viewers?
That's kind of like a tea time show, isn't it?
It's a tea time show. I feel that our producer Thomas Lewis might have been taking some tips from, or maybe That's Life from the 80s. It's a bit like an edition of That's Life from the 80s, isn't it? There's probably going to be like a sort of maybe someone whistling through a comb.
Let's be nice to our guests before they come on.
I'm only joking. It is going to be good. I'm interested to hear about these the Buddhas of Bamiyan.
Sounds like a
sort of Indiana Jones crusade, but in reverse, possibly.
Well, I won't reveal what's exactly been happening, but it's not been good.
Is that your teaser?
That's my teaser.
Well, that's a teaser. That's a teaser and a half. So decent guest lined up on the show. All we've done all week here in London is get wet feet, Andrew. We need to send ourselves away on a trip, don't we? Neither you or I have been away this week.
You had to take your shoes and socks off at one point.
Exactly. It sounds like I had sort of wade into work or something like that. Something sort of.
That you made the mistake of wearing a summer shoe.
I wore a summer shoe. I was fed up with my brogue. I was all broke down. Anyway, it's all coming up here. I don't know what episode this is. We normally tell people for some reason what episode it is. About 244 or something of that. 241 of the Monocle Weekly. Anyway, stay tuned to it. Because up next, I think it's going to be Tom Edwards.
All good.
It's Sunday, it's midday, live from London. This is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
That's my favourite of your introductions, I have to say.
What, the Pebble Mill introduction?
yeah, daytime TV one.
Wow.
Tom, welcome to the show.
It is a pleasure, he lies, to both of them. No, it's good to be here as always. Nowhere I like to be better at the middle of my Sunday than spending a bit of quality time.
Who needs roast potatoes?
Exactly.
Why don't we just come in here? Why don't we just put some on the end of a bamboo cane and lure any
unsuspecting news editors
to passing by?
Could try it.
Come on, let's up the ante. We can do better than this. Let's inject some enthusiasm into the show. What's number one on your list
of
news items?
It's a fast and furious and concise roundup.
Okay.
Tuesday.
That's happening on Tuesday.
Iran nuclear talks. The next stage. Check.
Okay, tick.
Obviously, they're sitting down with the P5+1 in Vienna on Tuesday. They got this temporary deal, which was agreed last time. Can they get something more permanent going? I don't know.
Okay, nor do we.
But they're going to try.
But we've got it in the diary.
Check that one for Tuesday.
The P5+1.
Exactly.
Okay.
Next day is Wednesday. See, nothing gets past me. Barack Obama, he's going to Mexico. It's the North American Leaders Summit. All the big dogs are there. You've got Obama.
Well, there's all three of them. The North American Leaders Summit.
Yeah, Enrique Peña Nieto and Stephen Harper. It's basically called the Three Amigos Summit, apparently. That's not me coining some awful racial slur. That's what it's called.
Okay. Which one's Steve Martin? Which one's Chevy Chase?
Chevy Chase, definitely Barack Obama, no?
Okay. I think that's the slur.
Is it? Anyway. That would mean Stephen Harper is Martin Short.
Martin Short, yeah.
Good. But at least they go to Mexico.
Yeah, exactly.
Rather than this time of year going up to Canada.
It's nice. Probably brisk up there, I imagine. Mm.
They can pack their shorts. It's good.
Could do. Exactly. I don't know. Is it clement in Mexico?
Yes, it's always clement in Mexico.
Is it always clement?
It's always nice.
You went there. It was freezing cold. Yeah, I remember.
I know I did come back with sunburn, but I tried very hard to get there on the last day.
I think it's almost unheard of for them to have bad weather in Mexico. Oh, so
really,
in Mexico City, it is. Anyway.
You really
Mexico
were
City, it literally was. It was -2.
I don't believe that for one second.
Honestly, it was -2. It was cold. I had to sleep in my fleece, genuinely.
You weren't in a different country.
I took a fleece because I looked
at it. Maybe he got on the wrong plane.
Were you in Macclesfield, not Mexico City?
Novosibirsk.
Should we keep going?
Yes.
Global rundown, Thursday.
Okay.
G20, Sydney. Do you want to know what the objectives are at this stage of the G20 thing?
I want to first know what the objectives are at this summit and then what comedy film it's like.
Okay, well, let's start. So, strengthening growth, create jobs, and restore full commitment to taking decisive actions to return to a job-rich, strong, sustainable, and balanced growth path.
That sounds absolutely intense. I'll tell you what that sounds like to me. Another Steve Martin movie. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Steve Martin and Michael Caine.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
And that's another classic.
That's good.
Yeah. From the Riviera.
Another 80s classic.
It's got, I think he drives a Rolls Royce Corniche.
He does, very nice, very nice.
Look at you, you like your cars. And Friday?
Friday.
That's happening as well next week.
Friday's also taking place, as per usual, barring Armageddon, unforeseen natural disasters. The International Lingua Pax Award. This is about mother languages. So to preserve the linguistic diversity, and they sort of recognise people who've done exceptional work preserving in particular native tongues in any given
so kind
market.
So challenged tongues, as it were, rather than saying protecting French against the onslaught of
this
English.
This is it. Well, but not exclusively that, because obviously there is this sort of gradual drift towards, you know, the Anglophonization of, you know, everywhere.
Apart from coming out of your mouth,
yeah.
The sound of it.
ironically,
one person.
I used an incorrect word. That was quite damning. But the nominations are announced.
And so, where are they holding it?
On Friday. I don't know. These are just the nominations, Andrew. Don't get ahead
of
yourself.
Sorry.
Is this telling us about which ones are in danger of being wiped out?
Who is most deserving?
Yeah. This is interesting. Because how many languages are there? There's like 7,400 languages around the world, aren't there?
But I think it's like that area of the rainforest the size of Wales that always is disappearing. You know, it's always in those terms.
Yeah.
These languages disappear, I think, at almost a daily rate.
Yeah.
So this is good. Let's try. And it's Mother Language Awareness Day on Friday.
Let's see.
So I encourage people to speak in their mother tongue.
Well, we should get the Welsh people in the office to speak Welsh on that day.
Well, that is a foul and ugly language, Andrew.
we're only saying that mainly because our producer at the other side of the glass is Welsh.
It's a beautiful, guttural sound.
And he does his bit to promote the mother tongue. He brings around a Welsh cake. Everyone, he comes back from Wales.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
He's done lots to promote.
I thought you were going to say he's always sharing his tongue around the office.
Well, I've heard that as well, but anyway.
Heavens.
And is that it?
That's not like any film I can think of.
No,
it hasn't been your most cheery list so far.
No, well, what about...
Dying languages.
One more serious one. On Saturday.
No, it hasn't.
One more serious one and then a fun thing to end
on. Okay.
So next Saturday... You know that I obviously love the World Cup in Brazil. Not everyone's happy about it in Brazil. Operation World Cup, who are a group who've been protesting about the World Cup and hemorrhaging public money, this sort of thing, they're calling for protests in Sao Paulo next week. And Operation World Cup were involved in those riots we saw across Brazil at the end of last month. So they obviously know how to G people up. So that'll be quite interesting. But for a lighter note, because that is a bit serious, protests and so forth, the Venice Carnival continues. Mm. Have you ever been to that, Rob?
I haven't been to it, no. I mean, I've tried to recreate it a few times.
Well, exactly. Theatre, music, parade, masked people and lots of heavy drinking.
What?
I don't know.
Steady on.
Don't point at Rob.
But that's, and it's great fun. You just have to watch out that you don't fall in the canal.
You obviously know Venice very well.
I was watching a thing about the Rococo the other evening on BBC with Valdemar Janáček, a great art critic. Mm. And I didn't know this about Venetian, the Venetian masks. The ladies' masks are very small and they were held in place by the teeth, so you couldn't actually talk. That's why the female mime is so coquettish, because you can just only slightly incline your head, or you're sort of, even the dilation of the eyes' pupils would potentially mean something. Whereas the men had those masks with sort of almost like a sort of Hoover type of thing underneath, like a sort of big scoop underneath, so you could eat and drink and talk. I thought that's an interesting...
I am going to campaign to reintroduce that around my house.
Around your house?
Yeah.
Well, you're actually around the area of your house?
Or just, house. Just in my house.
The okay. Missus.
Exactly.
She's going to be getting any
beautiful.
Drinks.
Nice and quiet. I can eat, drink and be merry. Wonderful.
This has turned back into That's Life from the 80s.
Yes. This is our retro show today.
It's our retro show, and thanks very much for that news look ahead, Jim Davidson. The Buddhas of Bamiyan, carved in the 6th and 7th centuries into a cliff along a section of the Silk Road in central Afghanistan, were among the country's most treasured works of art.
The international community looked on in horror as the country's then Taliban rulers destroyed the statues in 2001, claiming the monuments to be idolatrous and an affront to Islam.
Well, in the years since the Taliban-controlled government was toppled by NATO forces, the debate among archaeologists and art historians around the world on the future of the site in Bamiyan has been a long process.
But a fresh row over the future of the site has broken out, following the revelation that a team of German archaeologists have begun rebuilding the statues against the wishes of UNESCO and in the face of an internationally brokered plan of action which stated the statues remain unreconstructed, which was signed in Tokyo in 2011.
And joining us on the line now is Anna Somers-Cox, editor-in-chief of the art newspaper. Anna, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Now, maybe you can fill us in on exactly how this has sort of happened under the noses of the international community, this rebuilding programme by the Germans. How has it, A, happened and been allowed to happen?
Well, I think it's happened really because Bamiyan is a bloody long way away from anywhere, and there's nobody really watching. In fact, if anything, the ECOMOS people who did it were the people who were supposed to be watching themselves, and they got a bee in their bonnet, or rather it looks as though the head of ECOMOS Germany, Michael Petzet, got a bee in his bonnet and decided just to go for it.
Is there an idea here? I mean, we've said, and I think the article in the art newspaper said that the international community is sort of up in arms about this. Are there different rules for different nations? I mean, obviously, as you said, this part of Afghanistan is a bloody long way from anywhere. It's easier to do it there than anywhere else. Perhaps that's where these relics are. Is there a sense that there are different rules for different countries on this sort of thing?
No, they're not exactly different rules for different countries. I think they're different sensibilities in each country, but given that there had actually been a big international meeting in which Michael Petzet had taken part in 2011 in Tokyo to discuss what should be done there, and they had just precisely decided not to rebuild them, it seems rather extraordinary he just fired ahead and did it on his own.
Can I ask you, when we look at a capital city like Warsaw or many of the greatest buildings in Berlin these days, they were completely destroyed during the war. They were rebuilt. We realise they aren't the real thing, but somehow they still add to the grandeur of those cities. Is there anything wrong intrinsically with the idea of somebody feeling that these Buddhas should be rebuilt in some sense?
I think there's a slight difference between, shall we call it backdrop, which Warsaw was, and also which the citizens of Warsaw passionately wanted to have back, and something which is a sort of, okay, no longer venerated by anybody of that religion in that part of the world because everybody's Muslim, but was massively important religious sculptures of another age. For the Westerners to come in there and rebuild them almost as tourist attractions, and slightly, not in the face of the local population, but in the face of, shall we say, quite a lot of people in Afghanistan who would see that as a Western imposition. I think that the diplomacy of the two things are very different, quite apart from the fact that I've heard from very kind of aware people who've been to see the empty niches of the Bamiyan Buddhas, that you can still see the shadows of them, and they're incredibly impressive as is. And whatever you put up there will inevitably be a fake, because you see they're not exactly carved sculptures, they were actually cut out of the living rock. They were part of the rock. And what you would put in now would be something in a different technique. You'd inevitably have to sort of make a figure and stick it in there.
And the idea of someone going in, a team of people going in to do this sort of undercover restorations, a strange one, isn't it? We always think of these sort of swashbuckling explorers going into these countries and looting treasures rather than restoring them. But do you think it's sort of just as bad as that sort of the 19th century habit of, well, we'll put exploring in inverted commas, Anna, but is it in that similar vein, do you think?
I don't know what motivates Miss Betzler. I think he had his own passionate desire to try and recreate something. And I think they were in charge, actually, of doing some other work then. I think he probably just thought, well, I'm going to start, you know, and maybe I'll get away with it. I don't think one can extrapolate from that to sort of some great kind of Western imposition. I think really it's one man's enthusiasm.
And what do you think of the UNESCO's plans? Because I was looking at your report, and although they don't want to rebuild the statues, obviously, you know, they're keen to build a new bazaar. They're obviously keen, we're talking about the tourist element, but they're obviously keen to find some way of kind of balancing some respect for what's happened there to celebrate the culture a little bit. But they certainly seem keen to bring some tourists in there as well.
Well, the people there are desperate to get some tourists. They used to have quite a reasonable tourist industry there, and there used to be this kind of ramshackle bazaar built in local materials along the side of the road and selling, you know, drinks and little bits of handicraft. And this is what UNESCO is trying to do, is to provide these people with a living. And whatever would be built by Andrea Brunner, who's UNESCO's architect, would be in the local materials and would look as though it sort of really belonged. The idea that you should then have a kind of viewing space almost underground in front of the Bamiyan Buddhas, where you would have a circular window and you'd look up at the void almost as though you were sort of venerating an altarpiece or something, I think is rather nice and rather discreet and would be almost invisible. I think that's okay, because I think that sort of gives a focus to somebody who arrives there, and then there'd be some kind of small amount of background or something inside this viewing chamber. But yeah, I mean, the Hazara, who are the local people, very much miss their tourists.
And I wondered, Anna, on the long view of this sort of historical and artistic reconstruction, where does it well? Which places have presented their natural treasures? I'm wondering about Egypt and the Valley of Kings. Having been there, I'm not entirely sure I put them in that bracket. I wonder where's done it well in the past we could learn from.
Well, I think Ephesus in Turkey, where the Ostrians have done something called anastalosis, which is where you find all the bits of temples that have fallen down. And temples are built up rather like Lego, you know, bit of column, bit on top, another bit of column, on top, another bit of column. So if you can find all the bits of stone and measure them and fit them together like a great big jigsaw puzzle, you can actually rebuild temples and fit in a few where the missing bits. And I think that is legitimate, because there's a huge difference between seeing a mass of stones lying on the ground and then seeing them actually built up again. I think that's valid.
And I wanted to come maybe full circle. I know you're very interested in professionally and, you know, and passionately and privately as well in the restoration of Venice and keeping it above water. Is that the sort of thick end of the wedge of this sort of discussion, that if it weren't for a place being of such commercial value, it might fall into disrepair, it might fall into this sort of discussion we're having about a remote place in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't think commerce has come into the question of the Bamiyan Buddhas. I mean, apart from, I mean, obviously people wanting to help the locals, population. I think it's a bit of sort of restoration ideology going on there. I hope that people would keep Venice going even if it weren't a good business. And the paradox is it's such amazing good business and they're still not investing in it.
And just going back to Afghanistan finally, are they going to take down what was put up? Do we know what's going to happen to the bit that he kind of cobbled together?
Well, it's only the sort of stumpy little feet at the bottom. And I think they can be taken down very easily and almost certainly will be, yeah.
It sounds like they basically sort of tried to make Ozymandias.
Yes.
It's a strange thing.
Yes, do you know, I think it's sort of, exactly, I think it's a kind of almost poetic challenge.
Oh, it is. Anna, thank you so much for your time. Anna Summers-Cox, Editor-in-Chief of the Art Newspaper.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity. We bought into a factory.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9 to 5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
It's time for the music now on The Weekly. This is Proviant Audio with Once I Thought. That was Proviant Audio with Once I Thought. I thought Proviant Audio, Andrew, were going to be the kind of people you come around to fix your hi-fi. I mean, oh, I need a 3.5 millimeter jack. You hear people say that, don't you? People like jack.
I don't think people have hi-fis anymore, even.
Do they not?
No.
What have they got? Like a dock?
Have high tops, but not hi-fives.
High tops. We don't have enough guests with high tops on. Is that sexist? Let's just move on.
Okay.
This is the Monocle Weekly. Coming up next, what are we going to be doing? Oh, we're going to be doing the Productivity Ninja next, all dressed in black.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. The author Stephen King once said of the craft of writing, "Amateurs sit and wait for inspiration. The rest of us just get up and go to work." Well, that might be all well and good, but the truth is, in a world where there's more to do and seemingly less time to do it in, having the space to foster an idea and then the time to bring it to life can often feel like a luxury the demands of work and life in general rarely allow for.
Well, fear not, the self-styled productivity ninja is at hand to help. A short while ago, I spoke to the author Graham Alcott on how we might all lead more fruitful and more productive lives. Graham, thanks for joining us on The Weekly.
Good to be here.
I'm the productivity ninja. And before we start, we're going to talk about the productivity in fine detail, obviously, in a bit. But I wanted to ask you about the ninja part of that. It's nice having a picture of a ninja on your book, but what is it about ninjas that attracted you?
It is great, and it sells books as well. So we get lots of tweets of people saying, "I just want to be a ninja," and it's really cool.
Yeah.
The background to it is...
It's a shameless marketing ploy. Yeah.
Well, the background to it is over the last few years, I've been running a company called Think Productive. Mm-hmm. We do productivity workshops, and we didn't want to call the people who ran those workshops trainers or consultants because we kind of felt that people were a bit bored of that.
Yeah.
So we came up with this idea of ninja, and there was just a whole number of different characteristics that we felt were good approaches to productivity. Mm-hmm. So focusing on things like zen and ruthlessness and preparedness and all these traits that just kind of seem to fit. It's one of those things that quite a few people have talked about in different ways. So you'll find blog posts dotted around the web saying things like email ninja and task ninja and stuff like that. So it was just something that we, you know, really felt kind of reflected the work that we were trying to do. And then when it came to writing the book, it was like, well, that's just the obvious thing to call it. So it's How to Be a Productivity Ninja.
I would love a ninja to read this book. I'd love this book to be reviewed by a ninja. And they go, yeah, we'll obviously get it translated from the Japanese. Them saying, this is brilliant. This is all the tricks of my trade. If anything, I'm out of a job.
Well, I was a bit worried about that because when we... So the book was originally self-published. And then it was... the rights were bought by a great publisher called Icon, who then took it to the Frankfurt mm-hmm. Book Fair.
Yeah.
And they're sat with a big poster of the front cover of the book at the Frankfurt Book Fair trying to sell the translation rights to different countries.
Right.
And so there's me really worried, like, what are the Japanese delegations going to say when they turn up and see this, How to Be a Productivity Ninja? And then, so, you know, I gingerly asked that question back at Icon HQ after Frankfurt, and it was like, actually, it was really well received. They all smiled. They all loved it. And apparently it was one of the countries where it resonated more, actually.
Okay, right.
It was because of that ninja.
People knew it was a good thing.
Relation, so yeah.
Yeah. But it's not all about being a thief in the night or a sort of black-clad assassin. So where do you kick off from? Productivity. People want to be productive. They also want to be sort of creative. Do you find that those two things do you think those two things are mutually exclusive, or does being productive make you creative?
I think it's a bit of a myth that it's like this spectrum where, you know, creativity comes from crazy making people who have a lot of mess around them, and productivity is all about organizations and files. Like, if you look at my desk is often pretty messy. Like, I know that through techniques that we practice and things that we believe in, every now and again, I have to clear that stuff up. And I know I need to go back and make sense of all those messy scribblings that I write in my pad. But I'm quite chaotic in the way that I work. So I don't think it's, you know, I think there's a lot of books that are quite alienating because it gives this impression that you have to have everything A to Z filed and everything has to be ordered and perfect. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is the idea of anti-perfection. So actually to be productive with creativity, you sometimes have to resist that urge to hold on to the thing that you've created and like release it into the world even before it's kind of even finished in a way. You know, like a lot of software guys these days will talk about like, you know, shipping it really early. And it's, you know, which sort of comes from a Steve Jobs thing of real artists ship.
Yeah.
Which is like getting something out into the world. I guess
there's a way that your customers can fine tune the product. That's
And so if you're, you know, if you're creating anything, you know, you want to cling on to it until it's perfect before you put it out into the world. And often that's like the worst thing you can do. So I think, you know, coming back to your question, like productivity and creativity, I kind of see it's like a sort of dance between the two. Like you kind of have to be at times ruthlessly efficient, and at times you probably have to be a bit crazy and spontaneous with your schedule. And I think if you've got, you know, if you've got good systems in place and what I call in the book, the second brain, so having really good lists and a really good sense of what you're doing and what your purpose is and what you're working on, then it's easy from that point to be really spontaneous.
I like this idea of the second brain. Having skimmed around within the book, this is one of the sort of phrases that jumps out. Tell our listeners what the second brain is, because they might think it's just a slightly the punchline to a slightly rude joke. Not everybody has their second brain.
Yeah, so the idea with the second brain is that your own brain is not a great place for holding on to lists and information. And one of the ways that most people will get stressed is because you've got all these things bouncing around your head and what I call nags, you know, just things that are nagging you, people that are nagging you, stuff that will produce procrastination and stop you from getting stuff done. So the second brain is being able to manage all that stuff. If you think about what you do when you have appointments, you put them in a diary, you put them in a calendar, you don't think about them again. So in a way, the second brain is doing the same thing, but for projects and for actions as well. And then also having some checklists that kind of acts as the brain's intuition, and which is daily and weekly. So basically asking yourself really good questions at those points so that you're sort of gearing your choices around making, you know, really good decisions about what you could be doing.
And what about pressure? Because you said, people put things in their diary, put things in their calendar, and they don't think about it. And then they go, oh, 11 o'clock, I've got to do this thing.
Yeah.
And they see that at 10 o'clock when they get into work, or 9:30, whatever. How good is pressure for being productive?
Yeah, I think it depends on what kind of pressure it is. So I think...
I'm a writer. We have deadlines.
Yeah, yeah,
we have daily deadlines on this radio station. And then we have something every month, something every week as well. That always kind of gets my... I know that that's a way of engaging my brain. Is that true of most people? Do you find that the deadline, the sort of... The carrot and the stick, I guess this is.
Yeah, I think so. And up to a point. So what I was going to say is, you know, in terms of what kind of pressure it is, like if you... If you're stressed because you just know there's lots of stuff to do and it's just kind of quite vague in your head, then that's kind of bad stress. And you could describe that as kind of bad pressure. Mm-hmm. But in terms of like good pressure, I'm a big believer in deadlines. I'm also a big believer in a deadline is only real if it's to somebody else.
Right.
So, you know, setting your own false deadlines and saying, my deadline for this is Monday. It doesn't matter if you don't have to give that thing in until Friday or if it doesn't air until Saturday or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's like, you know, you have to, there has to be a genuine accountability to create that deadline. And then the other thing with deadlines is I kind of play around with deadlines. I like to create deadlines to give myself that kick up the backside sometimes, because quite frankly, like I can be quite lazy in the way that I work. And so that, you know, that's a really good way of me sort of knowing that about myself and then doing something about it. But if you had 20 deadlines, then of course you're suddenly in a very different situation. It's not motivating then.
I know that you take on clearly the contemporary office, the contemporary workspace in the book, and you talk about connectivity versus productivity, don't you?
Yep.
Now they seem to be two things that I always find that connectivity might make me unproductive because there's too much going on. I'm getting too many emails through.
Totally.
In terms of that, and there's a part where you teach people how to get rid of their inbox. I think I've got sort of 38,000 unopened emails in my inbox.
Right.
What is your advice, doctor?
Email doctor. So there's a chapter in the book called Ninja Email, which covers this in quite a lot of detail. But basically, one of the big problems with email is that people tend to use it as their to-do list. And it's very easy to be distracted from the stuff that really matters by the fact that there's new emails coming in. because A, you have notifications on your screen, and B, if even if you don't subconsciously, you know there's going to be more emails coming in. So people kind of live in their email inbox, and really the idea of trying to get your inbox down to zero is about saying, let's live outside of the inbox. So having done that, what that creates is, in effect, you know, somewhere else to put your brain. Like, so if you imagine if you're just in the middle of a work day, most people would seem it insane to turn off your Outlook or your Gmail or whatever your email system is. And yet, like, if you do that, you have a couple of minutes of panic of going, oh, where do I put my eyes?
What am
I
doing? It's great.
But yeah. Once that happens, you get perspective and you start to change how you think about your work. You're not so sort of entrenched in the kind of minutiae of detail, and you're able to think much more strategically about what you're doing. So we talk in the book about a whole series of different ways to sort of tackle email. And really it comes back to the whole kind of ninja approach to things, which, you know, looks at connectivity versus productivity and says, you know, actually the ninja needs to be in battle against the noise of 24/7 information that happens right now. So if you think, what's the first thing most people do in the morning when they wake up is pick up your phone because it's right next to you, and you turn off the alarm, and the next thing you do is probably open email. So it's like you start your day with everybody else's priorities and considerations, not your own. And it's before you've even woken up. So it's like, no wonder by the time we get on the bus to go to work or whatever, you know, we're already stressed out. So it kind of has this whole, knock-on effect that if you control email, you just regain a big proportion of your attention that you then have to be able to think much more strategically.
And aside from the book, I'm interested in how your business works, sort of teaching presumably business people, I presume, primarily how to be productive. Do they come to you with the same set of problems most of the time? I mean, is that the genesis of the book? I mean, or do some people really come from left field and go, oh, I really find it impossible to, you know, I don't know, do something that maybe is unfamiliar to us. Do you think most of the people from businesses that come to your consultancy, to your business, do they have the same problems despite the background of their company, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think you're right that there's probably two or three sort of key themes that just emerge time and time again. One is email. So it's like everyone's drowning in email, and how do we stop this? So we kind of have two ways that we deal with that. One is the personal survival stuff, which is what's in the book. And the other one is email etiquette. So thinking about what's the culture and the rules around this. Like, if you can get everyone together and say, stop CCing each other, you know, or these are the circumstances under which you CC versus here are the circumstances that you don't, it just saves absolutely, like, you know, acres and acres of time in large organizations very, very quickly. So we deal with email. We deal with just the fact that over the last few years, what's happened is, you know, most organizations have the same amount of work to do, but they probably have less people than they had 5 years ago. So there's just a whole, you know, sort of zeitgeist around people just drowning in too much stuff, too much information, like too many commitments to deal with. The other one is probably meetings as well. So lots of people who, a meeting culture develops where it's back-to-back meetings all day.
That's often the last refuge of the lazy.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely, because it's the easiest thing to do when you don't know what to do is say, I know what we'll do, we'll call a meeting. And it feels, and it's a bit like, you know, going and checking email again. It's a thing that feels really good and productive, but actually it's a distraction from what really matters. So that culture develops in organizations, and, you know, we come in and sort it out, basically, is what we do.
Nice. Well, never without his rope ladder and his all-in-one black-clad outfit. Graham Alcott is the productivity ninja. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us on The Weekly.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Graham Alcott there, author of Productivity Ninja, Worry Less, Achieve More, Love What You Do. No small claim. Speaking to me a short while ago.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. I think Robert's going to have that book by his bed from now on. Coming up after this short break, we'll be heading to Sweden's north coast to meet the maestro behind the country's newest ice orchestra. Do stay with us.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks. And they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You are tuned in to the Monocle Weekly right here on Monocle 24. Time for some music now. This is Lemon Sheets by Making Marks.
We let the sun dry our lemon sheets.
That was Making Marks with their track Lemon Sheets. And of course, it's very easy to get those things the wrong way around. I think we got it the right way around this time. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Now feast your ears on the cool strains of these hardy souls from Sweden.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is the Ice Orchestra. Not only do they perform within an icy cavern in northern Sweden, but each of the instruments is carved from ice. Throughout the winter months, in the town of Luleå, which sits just below the Arctic Circle, the orchestra performs in an ice auditorium, which seats around 170 people.
And the man behind the Ice Orchestra is Tim Linhart, and I'm delighted to say that he joins us on the line live now from Luleå on the northern Swedish coast. Tim, welcome to the Weekly.
Thank you.
And we should... my first question for you is, what is the most layers of clothes you've worn when playing your instrument?
I usually have about 47 different clothing articles on me when I'm doing the job.
You can tell he's telling the truth because it's not a round number, Andrew. He's not picked that. He's not said 50, he's not said 40. It's 47 exactly. Items of clothing. Yeah.
And Tim, tell us the tradition of having an ice orchestra. How does this come about?
Well, I've been an ice artist for about 30 years, and about 15 years ago, I had a friend who was building guitars, and the question came up between us if I could build an ice instrument, and his first question was, wow, how's that going to sound? And since that question has come out, it has pretty much swallowed my whole life.
And just tell me, we always think of instruments being made from wood for a very simple reason, that you get the kind of sound and resonance you need to kind of hit the right notes. But if you're making, when we say carved, is it kind of actually poured into a mold? You get this frozen body of the instrument. How does that actually affect the sound that you get from the instruments?
The sound of the ice is a little more clear and crisp than the sound of wood. And so you can hear all the details. We tend to think of a sound wave as a smooth, round kind of a wave that we see on a graph. But really, it's as it goes up and down the string, there's a lot of small complications in that sound that are sort of like teeth on the on the larger wave. And with ice instruments, you hear all those fine teeth. You can feel it in the flesh of your body. It makes your hair stand up.
And was the acoustic tendencies of instruments made from ice, Tim, what sort of attracted you to it? Or was it, can I do this in the first place? The sort of challenge of actually building these instruments themselves?
Yeah, and originally it was the challenge of building one. My first one exploded on me when I tightened the strings. And
what was the first instrument you made?
It was what I call the octobass. It was a gigantic 3-meter-long bass. I figured if you build it big, that'll be easier than building a violin, for example, to start with. So I built big and then worked my way down in size.
And Tim, just before we go any further, obviously your accent doesn't sound too thickly Swedish. How come you ended up in the town of Luleå with this orchestra?
My wife is from here, and she won the tug of war. So
notice how he didn't say lost the bet. So I want to let's investigate the sounds of these things. I mean, it's called an ice orchestra. Are there any parts of a regular orchestra that can't be wrought in ice? I mean, maybe the triangle might be the most simple thing to be able to do. But what are the most tricky instruments to make? Are they the ones that sort of require the most sort of fretting, the most stress of the strings and things like that?
Well, all the string instruments work just fine. They're the kind of the first and the easiest part of the orchestra. Then you get into percussion instruments. And the thing that, of course, we know that ice doesn't like is to be beat upon. That's what we do. We beat on it with a variety of different pads and rubberized sticks and so on. And so the drum section is very effective. We have an instrument we call the Rolandophone, which looks like a gigantic pan flute with the longest pipes being a little more than 2 meters, that you spank the pipes with rubber pads, and you get this groovy boom boom. Sounds a bit like an amplified electric bass, but more explosive.
So, Tim, how long do the instruments last? Can you just use them once, and then do you have to kind of throw them away, or can they be used again and again?
Oh, we use instruments all year, the whole winter.
You just have to add some water at the end of the night?
Yeah, you got to go through the instrument and look around all the back and the bottom and everywhere to make sure that the player hasn't melted a hole in it. And if there is a hole, then you patch that hole with the same snow and water material that it's built with originally. So you have to pay attention to the orchestra all the time because ice is always moving. It's always something's happening all the time.
And presumably you're obviously, you're kind of stuck on where you can play, Tim, aren't you, and your musicians. I guess you get a lot of invitations to play at different events, but you obviously have to take your thermometer along first, I guess.
Well, yeah, we play outside, except that we build the concert hall, which is made of snow and water. It's like a gigantic, very thick igloo. And for us, the best location is inside there because it's always the same temperature and there's never snow, sun, wind, all of the things that can affect our orchestra negatively. But you can build that in many places around the world. I've been from Colorado, New Mexico, Italy up in the Alps, and different places in Sweden. There's a lot of places who could enjoy this music.
I think we should hear a little bit more of this stuff, don't you, Andrew?
Oh, yes, please.
We've got a little excerpt. This is Copenhagen, and this features violin, guitar, bass, and a xylophone. That was the sounds of Copenhagen, and that was violin, xylophone, bass, and guitar. And the reason we're playing you that is because we're talking to Tim Linhart, the founder of the Ice Orchestra up in northern Sweden.
And Tim, while you were playing up in Luleå, do you find it's mainly locals coming to see you, or have you become a bit of a tourist magnet?
We get people from all over the world. In the last, I would say, 40 days, there has been word out about this. I would guess somewhere over 100 million people have heard about this last month, because it's just been an absolute nuclear explosion of press, because I think it's just hard for people to believe that you can actually do this.
And what's the most outlandish offer you've had? I mean, has sort of Saudi Arabian prince asked you to sort of play in his Riyadh, for example?
I had an offer to go on tour throughout the Middle East with a freezer truck and throw open the back doors and you know play all around the Middle East. But you know, coming from America, I thought, gee, I like my head. I'd like to keep it.
And Tim, just tell me that obviously you came to music playing traditional instruments, but are those kind of firmly left now in the wardrobe and forgotten about?
Well, I got to say, I didn't come to this with any musical background. I came to it with an artistic background in snow and ice sculpture. And I've had to learn every single aspect of music from the very beginning with this. And now I've built, I don't know, this might be my 14th or 15th orchestra that I've put together. And ordinary instruments are just ordinary. They don't have that kind of magical pop that an ice orchestra has.
And maybe you can just tell us finally, Tim, we all know about the sort of crazy figures fetched by those famous Stradivariuses and things like that, but how much would an ice cello cost me from your workshop?
They're just not for sale.
Okay.
they're not for sale.
That means Google him. That means email him on his private. So. Tim, and I understand you've just played a wedding this Friday with guests, presumably obviously the bride and groom booked you and were keen to hear the sounds of the ice orchestra. But what about the guests? Are you always performing against a sea of iPhones taking pictures and videos of you guys playing?
That does seem to be the wave of our times, and I used to ask people not to, but they were just dying. You know, they just can't cope with that concept. So I loosened up. I let everybody do what they need to, and I just kind of live with that.
Cool. Well, with the heating forever set to close to zero, Tim Linhart, founder of Ice Music and the Ice Orchestra up in North Sweden, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly.
Thank you.
And there we have it, Andrew. That was 241, edition 241. That was 241. So I'm just trying to speak in broken English. I think it's endearing. What do you think? Do you think it's going to go down well?
I think maybe I need to attend that language course about threatened languages.
Yeah, exactly.
English is really challenged on the show this week.
Terrible, isn't it? Upstairs earlier on, we were talking about sort of monocle version of the Archers.
Who? No, I wasn't.
Trying to find some sort of dialects around the office, you know, sort of like
a common dialect.
Who knows where Marcus Hippie's really from? Things like that. Okay. Saving these parts of the. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got plenty of languages. Yeah, yeah, you've got your Sussex accent.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. Who should we thank? Who do you want to thank? Should we thank our guests?
Let's thank all of our guests. Tim Linhart with his nice frozen instruments.
He was good, wasn't he? Graham Alcott was quite interesting with his productivity ninja. I was pretty disappointed he didn't come in character. In a lycra onesie with a hood on. Like a sort of Spider-Man, like a dark Spider-Man. That's what I was expecting. But anyway, nice chap.
And Anna Summerscott.
Anna Summerscott's always good.
Great voice.
I think that's amazing. Imagine if some sort of German builders came and started kind of doing up your house. You wouldn't worry about that, would you? I think perhaps I've missed the subtlety of the argument there. Anyway, that was the 241st Monocle Weekly. We should also thank our team behind the glass, Thomas Lewis, and our studio manager, Claire Urban. And we'll be here, we'll probably be here same again, same time next week, all the rest of it, won't we?
Yes, please.
G up, giddy up. For the time being,
Can't
for me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.